The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I am Priscilla Suero, the first deputy director here at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and I'm thrilled to welcome you to tonight's author event and discussion. Now, what everybody's been waiting for, it's my pleasure to introduce our guests to the stage. Tamara Hall is a celebrated broadcast journalist, television talk show host, and author. After earning a degree in broadcast journalism from Philly's own Temple University, there you have it. Tamara went on to earn 2 Daytime Emmys for Outstanding Informative Talk Show Host for her self-titled talk show, as well as NAACP Image nominations, a Grace Award honor for Outstanding Talk Show Host, and honors for groundbreaking work against domestic violence. Tamara debuted her first novel as The Wicked Watch in 2021, kicking off the Jordan Manning series. Manning is a smart and determined crime reporter who earned her stripes covering a serial killer terrorizing her home of Chicago. Hall's latest book, Watch Where They Hide, brings us to the next chapter of Manning's journey. Joining Hall on the stage is a fellow journalist and broadcaster and beloved author event interviewer, Tamara Edwards. Yeah, we can clap a little. So we are pleased to have them join us this evening. Please join me in welcoming Tamara Edwards and Tamara Hall to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Like Alicia Keys right now without the piano.
So welcome home.
Thank you. What a warm welcome. Thank you.
And it is wonderful to have you here at the library talking about your second Jordan Manning book. Tell everybody who she's named for.
Oh, well, gosh, should I tell in this audience? It's Philadelphia. Michael Jordan? And Peyton Manning? I know. This is the truth. I fell asleep watching that ESPN documentary where we learn Michael Jordan pretty much hates everyone.
Right.
Did you see this documentary? It was phenomenal. And I think I fell asleep and I woke up and I was like, Jordan. Okay, that's her name. Jordan. This is before Jalen. I would have done Jalen.
Yeah.
It's pre-Jalen. We didn't know Jalen yet like we do. So Jordan. And then I was like, Jordan, and then what's the opposite? Manning. Okay. You know, and I just kind of pieced it together from there. But there was no, you know, it's so weird how the name came to be. And also I have a lot of Jordan sneakers, which people know me for my heels, but I have probably more Jordans than I have heels, surprisingly.
Right.
So, yeah, I know. Nobody knows these things about me, but that's diminishing now that my nieces all wear my shoe size. So,
well, I think Jordan, she's in a quest for love. I think in the next book she should meet a handsome quarterback who's from Houston and has something to offer.
I hear that. I'm going to have to jot that down.
So we met Jordan in As the Wicked Watch, and she was investigating violence against black women who were turning up and taking it further to figure out what happened to them. And now she is back here in Watch Where They Hide. And I wanted to talk to you about why you knew it was going to be a series and how, your process, because it's different, like how you decided the elements that were going to be in this book and the process and where it was going to take you.
Well, first of all, I do have to just properly thank my family members who are here in the house. I have many people in my life who are family, and they thought they were only going to see me Easter, but surprise, surprise. So first, thank you. So when I thought about Jordan Manning in this whole book series in the first place. I'd done a show called Deadline Crime for 6 seasons. Hey. 6 seasons of Deadline Crime. And I started doing that show because I'm a person who, and my family who knows me from Philly, I get that itch. I always want to do something new, something different. And so I'd done Deadline Crime, and the last season of Deadline Crime, I got pregnant. My son is actually here in the back somewhere. Moses is here. And so I was pregnant at the time with Moses, and I did a case in Oklahoma. And it was a woman who was pregnant, and she was murdered, brutally murdered. It was one of the most horrific cases I'd ever covered. And when I came back from that case, I was in the audio booth, much like this. You know, you have a microphone, and you're reading the story, the script. And I was thinking to myself, there are people reading Baby Einstein or listening to beautiful music, and I'm reading a murder. And can my child feel the tension? So I said, I never want to do this again. I am done with this. The pandemic happened, and we're all at first thinking, you know, we're going to die. And then we realized that, God willing, there was going to be a vaccine and all these emotional things. And then you start to have perspective over life. Because I think in modern time, there was no other moment where we all really thought, do I have more chapters in me? Is this, you know, wait, life is fleeting. In the blink of an eye, things can change. So I'm there in my home, and my husband is here. I was so completely bored with him, too. Sorry, I love you, though. I was sick of Amazon boxes and all of the things that happen in life. And I said, you know what? I think I want to write a novel. People had approached me about writing books of inspiration and memoirs and things like that. And I said, I just want to do something different. Life is so short. Why not just do it? What could go wrong? If it's bad, it's bad. If it's great, that's even better. But I was almost 50, and I wanted to do something. So that case in Oklahoma had stuck in my mind. There was a case in Chicago that I'd covered, an 11-year-old girl who was murdered. The same year I covered her case, I'd covered a child in Texas the same age. I couldn't shake any of those. So I started to use how I felt with those cases to create these storylines through Jordan. So with Jordan, I was able to give her credibility of having been a journalist, a true crime journalist. But the luxury of fiction gave me an escape route because I didn't want to write a true crime based on letter for letter everything that I'd seen. What I wanted was this juicy character, this black woman who is not just electric in her presentation on TV, but in her heart and her soul, so much so that she's willing to risk her own life to solve the crimes. She doesn't want to be a witness. She wants to be a witness and a participant to right what is wrong. When I was on Deadline Crime, I could only be a witness. And that caused me great anxiety. I say PTSD, and I don't use that lightly. There were times I just couldn't shake it because you're not meant to go to a scene where an 11-year-old has been killed and forget where you were. At least I am not meant to do that. And so I had Jordan to be able to share some of these experiences. And so my writing process, I just pick up this recorder thing because I have fabulously wonderful long nails. So I'm not typing anything. And so I would pick up my voice recorder, and I would just start creating the story, creating the storyline. So the foundation is always actual cases that I covered. The layers come from imagination. I was a ferocious, and I'm a ferocious reader. I grew up with Nancy Drew and all those little books underneath my bed that my father would get mad at me because they were all so dusty, but I would never get rid of them. So those are the tent poles for creating something like this in Jordan.
And there are layers to the book because Jordan brings in a number of dynamics and that come from your own life as well, which is people see one thing on the outside, but there's still the things you deal with, the way people talk to her in the newsroom, the things she has to think about, the way she responds.
There's a line in this book where I say, when you're a black woman, everyone thinks you're their boss. They're your boss, everyone. And I and
but you're bossy.
But you're the bossy one, which is the line, and that was a very specific line because I, even now being the executive producer of my show, being part owner of my show, thank you. It is remarkable how many people on a daily basis treat me like they are my boss. I laugh at it sometimes, but then there have been times I have to pull people over and say, "Andy, that name is mine." And I don't do that to flex on anyone. I do that because I am responsible for 250 people that are a part of my staff. And most important, I'm responsible and accountable to myself. And I work very hard to get where I am. And I won't shrink down for anyone. And that's what you see in Jordan. You know, Jordan is in her 30s. And while I hope I exude confidence in many respects on my good days, Jordan is a lot more confident than I was in my 30s. I mean, she is confronting people in the newsroom. She is speaking up in the newsroom. She is saying things I never felt comfortable because I was afraid I was going to be shown the door. I mean, I started in the business when there was one black woman in the newsroom, and when I was coming in to be interviewed, she knew we were about to exchange spots. She was going to be leaving, and I was going to be coming in. And that was the fact of it. I replaced the same woman who I loved two times. I replaced her in Dallas, and I replaced her in Chicago. Because in the 90s, in way too many newsrooms in major cities, it was one for one.
Were you all able to talk about this? Did you ever sit down
together? No, because you don't talk about trauma like that. I mean, we talk about, the reality is, you know, I'll tell you, when I left, when I was getting ready to leave MSNBC, and I knew I was leaving that day because I'm one of those people, obviously, I think God puts those signs and signals in front of you, you have to be able to see them. And so I started to prepare myself because it was, they just become so glaring, and I knew it was coming. I hadn't told anyone but my mother. I said, "They're going to get rid of me." And she's like, "Oh, my mom's very sensitive." She said, "They ain't that crazy." I was like, "Yes, they are." And I would leave the Today Show, walk over to MSNBC, and then do Deadline Crime on the weekend. So I'd left the Today Show that day. I walked to my office at MSNBC, which is across the street. I'll never forget it. And for some reason, I took this particular elevator bank that I don't normally take. I don't even know why. And I saw the three people who make decisions leaving this room. And I said, "God, it's going down." It makes me a little emotional now, not because I'm sad, but I'm telling you, every day in your life, there are signs. And that was one that I am not a big testify kind of person, but I'll tell you, God presents your path, and you have got to open your eyes to it. And that's why I never cried. I was never angry. I was never sad, because I saw it. I saw it coming, and I went to do the show that day, and my agent, my then agent, because he should have saw it too. My then agent texted me and he said, "This is the situation." And I said, "I'm good." And I went home, I prayed, and I called Joanne Reed. And I said, "They can't get rid of both of us. You better go get your money and negotiate hard." Because I knew the time of one for one wasn't possible. And Joy, I knew, was in the middle of her negotiations. So I encouraged her to be defiant, to stand her ground, to know her value, and to know her worth. She's the first person I called.
I think it's amazing that when you were having a hard time, you lifted someone else up and didn't just go get in a bathtub and cry.
Well, that's because that's happened to me so many times. I mean, I moved to Philadelphia, 1,528 miles from my parents' doorstep in Texas to a dorm room on, you know, Jones Hall. I don't even know if that is still open. Jones Hall was there. And this beautiful woman in the front row, Chandra Calhoun, who is from North Philadelphia, was in my class one day, the day after I had gotten my handbag snatched. because I'm a newbie and I didn't know the rules and all these things. And I said, I looked at her in our class and I said, that looks just like my handbag. And she was like, what, you sound from Norfolk, girl, don't play? I was like, I didn't know the rules. I was new. No, what she really said was, I'll walk you to the police station and put in the report. And then my mom lives around the corner. She loves cooking. Her name is Chloe. I was like, black people call their mamas by the first name. Y'all in Philly are wild. I was like, she said, my mom, Chloe. And I walked over to Chloe's house in North Philadelphia where they fed me, where they took care of me, where they gave me a home and support 1,528 miles from my parents. I've always been surrounded by women, by families who've lifted me. So I don't know how to do anything else but extend it to other people. It's not something I don't know how to do.
Thank you, and thank you. Another thing, a theme in the book, is Jordan figuring out what she really wants. What other people want for you is different than being okay with what you want for you. Even if somebody else is like, but that's bigger.
Right.
She figures out, no, but this is what I want.
That's why she's, I think, a wonderful character. And I think and I hope that when you read this book, you find her relatable. Because I believe, again, we all have these times in our lives where we're pulled in many directions. So here's Jordan now in this book, Watch Where They Hide. She's a successful reporter. She's had great success after solving this big case in the first book. People ask me also, too, do I have to read the first one or read the second one? You don't. The plan was for them to be freestanding. I wanted Jordan to feel like this person that you've always known. And I think you can relate to that. You meet somebody, you're like, I feel like I've always known you. And I wanted that texture to her. So now she's doing very well. She solved this case. In the first book, she's investigating the disappearance of a young black girl. And she talks about the disparity within the newsroom. And she cannot understand why this case is not getting the attention that others do. But in her heart, she knows why. And she's put in this position to speak truth to power in this newsroom. So now she's moved up the ladder, and she is AKA Justice Jordan. And the reason why I wanted her to have that moniker is when I did Deadline Crime, especially once the show started to do well, and people then knew that my sister was an unsolved murder, I would walk into rooms to interview people, and I could see in their eyes, before they would say a word, it was like a lifeline. It was like, Tamron is going to hear me. Tamron is going to treat my sister's story right because it happened to her sister. Tamron is going to treat my family right because she understands this. And that's a responsibility. And it's one that I to the day of my last day on this planet, I will always hold that dearly to my heart, that people trust you enough to believe that you're on their side. And with Jordan, I wanted Justice Jordan to have that same thing. But now here she is in this book, conflicted because she has been asked by the sister of a woman who is missing, who happens to be a white woman, who lives in a rural area, a mother of two, very different than Jordan, but she finds the same compassion and the same drive to solve this case. And now that's put her at odds with her career. She doesn't know if she wants to be a journalist. And I actually now see her creeping into this area of being a vigilante, of taking matters into her own hands. And I know some people bristle at that word. They say vigilante. Isn't that, you know, someone who's a bad person? But I always ask myself, how far would you go to do what's right? If you saw a child being abused, would you kidnap the child to get them out of the way? Because that's illegal. That's a crime. If you knew that, I don't know, if you knew there was a murderer in your neighborhood and you were certain that that person was targeting another victim and you were the only person who could stop them, what would you do? What if people don't listen?
Yeah.
Because the case in Cleveland, Ohio, where all of those women were found, no one would listen. You know, there's always this line, right? You think, I'm going to scream, I'm going to tell. But imagine all of the communities right now where they are invisible because no one would believe you. When I moved to Philadelphia, the case of the man who what was his name? Gary Heidnik in North Philly. And people had said for weeks and days and months, something's not right. And so you have Jordan feeling that there are so many people who need an advocate, and holding a microphone as a reporter to her may not be enough.
Another aspect of Jordan is the very personal. I thought about Jill Scott's just running across my mind as she thought back over a boyfriend and the reality she's coming to that he didn't want for me what I wanted for me, but who's going to want that for me?
Yes.
And I thought that was a really deep, you can see the door, but you don't need to walk through it.
Yeah. With Jordan, you know, she's got this thing where, it was important for me to have this black female character that you also see her personal life. You see her in her 30s. She is single. She loves life. She loves dating. She loves being social. But she doesn't feel that she can have both. She feels that if I'm going to succeed as a black woman in this newsroom, I have to put everything into this job. I think with her, and what was important for me to make her such a strong black female protagonist is that when I sold the book, four publishers wanted to buy the book. And they all said, in the thriller world, there is no black female journalist solving crime written by a black female journalist anywhere. And I believe they only bought it because I had 5 seasons and 2 Emmys. I don't think I'm the first to pitch this idea. But I think people struggle to sometimes see the hero as a black woman. And I wanted her to have all of these beats of friendships and familia and all of these. I mean, we're not a monolith, of course not. We don't all think the same. We don't all dress the same. But there are certain, Denzel Washington, someone asked him, what's the difference in race and culture? And he said, culture is knowing what a hot comb smells like. And I love that. I was like, that's it. It's culture. So I wanted her to have that culture. And I thought a lot about moments, for example, in my own life. I attended the Million Woman March here in Philadelphia as a reporter, but also as a black woman, and that culture. Unity Day. I grew up in rural Texas. We didn't have movements and moments like that. So I needed her to have that. But I also wanted her to be seen as herself. I mean, I was very, the first book made the Amazon bestseller list, and they had it under black books. And that bothered me because I said, well, okay, James Patterson is white. Alex Cross is black. Did you put James Patterson under black authors? And that wasn't me running from my blackness or hers. But as you know, as a journalist, our job is to go in and be a reporter, no matter who or what the story is about. Jordan is a true crime character who happens to be black, written by a black woman. Her experience and what she is doing doesn't fall under this box. Mm-hmm. And that's why the second book also, the victim is white. Because I said, now what you gonna do?
Put you on the New York Times bestseller list. That's what they'll do. You mentioned your sister in that experience as well as doing crime stories. And one of the characters here, where you really go with the sister, is the way people come to Phil. Nobody wants to talk to you. They've taken enough calls. Yeah. No one will hear from you. They think they're crazy. As I read that, I wondered your own personal experiences. Mm-hmm. Was there an element of you, unless you've stood there, you don't know what it's like to want to make 1,000 calls, to want somebody to come sit with you, to want somebody to talk to you, but they won't.
No, I mean, so when I wrote this book, as I said, 2 cases in particular were in front of mine. The Oklahoma case, where the woman was stabbed 19 times while she was pregnant. She was a woman who was living in the trailer home behind her mother-in-law's trailer home and decided to make money. She would go on Craigslist and have sex for money. Her husband encouraged her to do it. Her ad was answered by a man, unbeknownst to her, who was a serial killer. And I walked the area where she was in the middle of the night running for her life and took a lot of the emotions that I felt and put it in this book and in Jordan. The other case I covered was out of Virginia. It ended in Michigan. Her body was found 8 years after her husband murdered her, and the only reason he told was because they offered him an Xbox. So I took those things and poured them into Jordan, and these are real cases that I covered, and you can just imagine, this woman had children with this man, laid in the bed with him, had meals with him, loved him, and he traded her remains, essentially, for an Xbox. And so that's where Jordan's drive comes in from this case. When I got done with the book, I realized that Shelley was me. When my sister was murdered, we got a call from the detective saying, we know who did it, but there's not enough evidence to prove who did it. And felt helpless. You know, I was in Chicago at that time. I wasn't a national reporter. You know, there was a lot of secrecy in our family because of the domestic violence we knew she had encountered and endured. There was a lot of secrecy because she had her own struggles with alcohol, and she was doing great and had rebounded in her life and was on her way to the life that she wanted and deserved. And it was a phone call that she was on with my mother that same night, we believe, triggered the events, because she said to my mom, I'm ready to leave. And my mother said, absolutely. And we think that person overheard the call. Because what we know is when a woman is preparing to leave, it is the most dangerous time. So we had all of this anecdotal and circumstantial evidence. But when we asked the detective, and this is why Jordan's background is forensic science, when we asked the detective, well, what about DNA? And he said, when someone lives with you, their DNA is all over you. And so we just started to, and I met a wonderful, Tamara, the prosecutor who's in, right? It's just, there's a wonderful prosecutor who's here. If you need her, let me know. I got. See, I remember the prosecutor's name. See, Tamara? I know my priorities. But yeah, all of those things that you think that you see on CSI in 48 hours and how quickly cases are solved, that doesn't happen in real life like that. And so we felt helpless. And I remember the prosecutor telling us, the investigator saying, well, maybe you can take out a Crime Stopper. And I said, well, we know who did it. Why would we take out a Crime Stopper? And at that point, we felt helpless. And the person who murdered her was at the funeral. He was in front of me at the funeral. And because we were told, just let us investigate. You're nodding because you know this. Let's just act like you don't know. And the only moment that we eventually got to the point where we couldn't take it anymore, and that's where you see Shelley's frustration. My mom and dad had gone to the place where they were preparing her, and he came in, and my mother lost it and said, we know what you did, and he, you know, denied it or whatever. And the day of my sister's funeral, and I've never told this in public, my dad always, I'm kind of the badass in my family, so if nothing else, I'm like really direct. And my dad said, give him a call. And I called him, and I told him that we knew, and I made it very clear to him where we stood with him. And we never saw him again. We've gone to her grave, because her gravesite is near my dad's, and my mom believes that he has come by before. But there was a helplessness. There's a embarrassment. You know, many times people said to me, if that was my sister, I would da-da-da-da-da. And then you're like, am I not doing enough? You know, I had someone once tell me, if that was my sister, I would have killed him. Would you? So that, you don't know what you'll do. And that's why I needed Shelley. And so in this book, when you read Shelley, a lot of what she's feeling is a lot of what I felt. and the anxiety I felt and the helplessness. But I still say that to say, with all of that heaviness that I just shared with you, fiction was my escape. So that's why you see her preparing. Jordan is preparing for her friend's wedding.
Right.
She is going on dates. And because in life, your darkest times are not the total time. Mm-hmm. And I needed her to have that escapism because I didn't want you all just to read the book and say, is this Tamron? Is that Tamron? I wanted you to celebrate this refreshing character that doesn't exist in this genre, who really is you. She is your sister. She is your friend. She is the person that you like to hang out with, not the one you're happy that they're gone. She is the person that if something is wrong, you are going to call her because Jordan is going to take the call and she's going to get you out of jail or get you out of that trunk because she's going to save you much better than I ever could.
She's going to do more than just hold your bail
money. Oh, she's going to hold. She's not going to hold your bail money. She's going to get you out.
And I'm sort of wondering with your sister if something in you said, my mother can't lose another daughter. I can't do what those people are saying because I've got to be here.
No, because I'm not going to break the law and take, I would never, it never crossed my mind. It never crossed my mind. Because imagine every family impacted by violent crime taking it into their own hands.
Yeah.
It never crossed my mind. My mother was never in jeopardy of losing me. My mother and my family recognized that our power was eventually in helping survivors of domestic violence, which is why we created the Tamron Renata Fund, which is why I work with survivors and families of domestic violence. That's our power. You know, we decided as a family that we weren't going to, you know, I have a rule, even with the Today Show and even if those things that happen, I can't fly if I allow dust to stay on my wings. So I am, you know, and they say brush your shoulders off. I take that literally in every aspect of my life and not in a flippant, you know, haters and brush, no. In anything in your life, anything right now that is heavy on your heart, anything that is bothering you right now, you have to be able to deal with it and let it go. Heartbreak, loss, because how are you going to fly? And I believe every person has the capacity and the ability to soar past so many things you can't think. They said God doesn't put anything on you can't handle.
Right.
God didn't put this on my family because we couldn't handle it. When it was time, we recognized the power was to help again. Like this lady took me in her home. The power was to help other people. And so I met a little boy once at a shelter. And I'll never forget this moment. He came over, and he's so cute, and he's like, you know, typical little boy hanging out at this shelter. He doesn't even really know where he is. And the woman said to me, "This, we are so happy to see him smile, because when we first took them in, he's like six. He told them, you know, I sleep with one eye open every night, and last night I was able to sleep with both eyes closed." In his mind, as a little kid, he was sleeping with one eye open. The counselor pulled me over and she said, he thought, oh, it makes me cry. He thought in his child's mind that he was keeping an eye open, protecting his mom.
Oh.
And he was all smiles because in his mind, he finally got some sleep. Meanwhile, he didn't know all those other nights. She was the one with sleepless nights, worried about him.
Watching him.
And so, you know, that's power. So to that individual who we believe is responsible, through that, you know my sister's name. You are able to now see perhaps someone that you love and say, well, Tamron went through that. It happens. How do we as a family talk to her and support him or her in this process of leaving? Because that's what we're doing now.
In the book, Marla, who is the sister who has disappeared and the one that Shelley is looking for, is a complicated character.
Mm-hmm.
And often people will have a character be very one or the other, the perfect mother, the perfect whatever. We find out she's a very complicated person. I would imagine in the work that you've done, we're so quick to want to put people in a box. You're worth our sympathy if you're this, but what if you're that? That there was a message in that she still deserved better.
Absolutely. You know, those two cases I go back to, the woman in Oklahoma, you know, she was what people would have probably called, you know, trash, right? She you know, she struggled with substance abuse. She's got, and in fact, someone did call her that when she went missing. There was a dismissing of her, and we see that all the time. And for me, with Marla, it's the opposite. Marla's a complicated character because she was living this perfect life, right? She's gotten this house, this man, he does well for himself. She was supposed to be the sister who made it. And in fact, she may have been with, maybe sleeping with the enemy. I don't want to give too much away, but because it is supposed to be a mystery, it's supposed to be a thriller. And my whole goal, if you watch GMA, and I stand on this, I want to keep you up for at least 2 days. When you finish this book, if you manage to go to sleep right after that, I'm going to take you to dinner. Because I want you to be sleepless. I want you to look at the sky. I want you to shake your fist and say, damn you, Tamron Hall. In fact, I want you to run up the rocky steps and flip me the bird. I don't care. I don't care because I really labored over this. Listen, I want credibility in this space. I'm a super competitive person. And so I was like, I didn't study other thriller writers, but I thought about things that keep me up. I thought about twists and turns. I mean, I changed this ending 4 or 5 times. My husband was like, when he read, he was like, what is in your sick mind? I was like, you better not close that out tonight. I was like... Because it is a work of fiction. I had the ability to create scenes and scenarios. So, yes, I mean, and thank you for indulging me in talking about my sister. And thank you, but I did not, and I do not want you to believe that it's this kind of night for me. I am so lucky to be here. I have written a novel. Yes. I mean, I am thrilled. Thrilled. And I have written a novel, you know, defying even my own expectations in a world where creativity, I mean, I drove around today looking at all those murals, and we know that Philadelphia is known for these beautiful murals. Creativity is important, and it keeps me exhilarated. And so now we're going to get wrapped on this. We're done.
No, he's just bringing up some questions.
No.
I was like, what time is it? Damn. I know I give long answers, but damn.
I've got one quick question before I start getting into your questions,
please.
And it's about your show.
Yes, ma'am.
Which has been beautiful to watch. What
Thank
a phoenix.
You.
I still remember watching you for the first time filling in on the Today Show as the newsreader. And I said, this is different. This is different. Who is this? What's happening?
It was so different, they showed me the door.
No.
I joke about it because it's hilarious. I can't wait to write my memoir one day. You can't make it up.
I want to be the one who gets to talk to you about it.
I said, I need a couple of more people to die. Listen, I'm sorry, I have a morbid sense of humor. You'll have to live with it. No, I'm kidding. I don't want them to die. I want a couple around to read it.
But
She thought that about me? I did.
Sure did. But I think, you know, you stood out because you were willing to let your hair, your fashion, your laugh, everything be yours. And I've watched you with your show. If you watch a lot of the other talk shows, you could just move those hosts in and out. Your show is so different. Who you choose, who you bring, who
Thank
you're
you.
Uplifting, the space that you're creating.
Thank you.
And I wanted you to talk to them about, but that takes so much courage. Because so many people would say, these are the celebrities, these are the musicians, these are the things, stick with these people. And you've decided, like Jordan, to go your own way. And that takes courage, and I wanted you to talk about that.
You know, I would love to say it was courage. I didn't want to get canceled. So I was like, I studied the landscape. I'm a TV junkie. I mean, I sleep with my TV on. My husband will tell you to his chagrin, I still sleep with my TV on. I studied, it's like a sport. You study other people and you see where they've made their mistakes. I ran track my whole life until I came to Philadelphia and realized that they were way faster at the pin relays than I ever could be. I studied. I'm a prolific studier. I actually, to be honest with you, I've looked up old episodes of Mike Douglas. I mean, people always point to Oprah, for example, as the shining star, and of course she is. But I studied all of these shows. I remember... you know, watching episodes where Muhammad Ali was on, you know, arguing with a segregationist on a daytime talk show. I am so proud to say this week, Luther Campbell, Two Life Crew, will be on my show. It's like the first time. Thank you. I know. Because he is executive producer of Freaknik. Exactly. And he does not believe I never went to Freaknik. So I'm going to get into it with Uncle Luke on the show. But the real reason he's on, he won a Supreme Court decision on freedom of speech. We're in a library. I mean, the very complicated parts of this individual, he was on daytime shows. I mean, Donahue had Luther Campbell on arguing in an epic episode of that show. So I just studied what I felt was missing. And I said, okay. And I will receive the word courage on one component of it, which most people don't know. They did not want to let me be the executive producer of the show. They didn't. We had done the contract. Everything was done. And they said, no. In fact, those people aren't even in the building anymore, so I can tell this story. But they did not want me to be executive producer. And they said, because she would have too much control. Because when you're executive producer, no one can tell you what to do with the show. And I will receive the courage because I did say, then I won't sign the contract. I did. And so the vision of the show wasn't courageous. It was more calculating. And also more what I find interesting, to be honest with you. The hard part really was the stomach churning hours waiting for them to give in.
Right.
On the executive producer.
But I will say, I see people on your show I don't see anywhere else. Yeah. And I see us in that show.
No, we're so lucky. You know, because honestly, I'll tell you, Michael K. Williams, the phenomenal actor who was on our show and had become a friend of mine, he was on our show and we were talking about his struggles. And he talked about, from his perspective, people want to focus on what drug you're using or what drug you used versus why. Right. Mm-hmm. And it was a very powerful episode and we're both crying. And a few months later, I ran into him randomly. And this is where we're all, well, I had a mask on. He didn't. And because he's so Brooklyn, you know, so he's walking around and he said, I know those eyes. And I look over and I was like, oh, my God. And we hug and hug. And he started crying and he said, thank you so much for having me on your show. And I said, you're Michael K. Williams. He said, they never want to book me on those shows. Mm. And you and I both know.
Yeah.
And so I just burst into tears and we cried. But to have him, this phenomenal award-winning actor, say he didn't often fit the mold of what people would book on daytime shows and that our TAM fam gave him a landing spot, I couldn't believe it. We had Carl Anthony Payne Jr. on our show the other day. He's been a Cosby Show star. Martin, one of the most iconic. He'd never been on a daytime show ever. Ever. He was on Martin. One of the most, in an iconic character. He wasn't like the guy in the back on Martin. He was one of the friends. And he had never been on a daytime talk show. It's crazy.
Bringing in some of the audience questions, and this is a good one. They want to know who you want to play the role of Jordan Manning. I want to know, are you going to write screenplays? Are you going to start directing?
Well, you know, we have sold, the book has been optioned by CBS, so they own it right now to turn it into a series. So they've optioned it. We're working on a screenwriter right now. I don't know if I want it to be, you know, like an episodic, I'm not sure, but they have the book and they own the book and they're working on it with me. Mm-hmm. And they're working on finding the right format, you know, is like, but I have no idea who would play her. I was talking with Michelle Williams from Destiny's Child. She has a forensics background. I was like, Michelle. Destiny's Child, read this line. And she's like looking at me like, you're a crazy woman. But, you know, I don't know. So Jordan's best buddy is a doorman named Bass. Mm-hmm. I would love Drewski to play face. I just Drewski was on the show and I fell in love with him, and he's so sweet and funny. And I the minute I saw him, I was like, you could be bass in this. I like this. So at least have him cast. Everything else, I don't know.
I don't know. So they want to know what characteristic of Jordan's is similar to yours.
Oh, her inability to shut up. I talk a lot. I got in trouble a lot. I went to Catholic school. And if you have a very talkative child, don't silence them.
Yeah.
Yes.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to be a published author?
Oh, wow. That's an interesting one, because I actually quite admire people who self-publish. I really do. I know it's hard, and if I had it to do again, I probably would have explored how to put the Tamron Hall show on, like, YouTube. But mm-hmm. a real, like, I so desire to completely own my show.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much fun of mine. And I'll be honest, I toyed with not continuing after this season, because I wanted to figure out, first of all, I like the idea of leaving on a high note. You're like, mm-hmm. And I'm currently executive producing a couple of shows. Hopefully that will be on very soon. And I have a cookbook that I just sold that comes out. And I know, surprise, surprise. Don't you say anything. I can cook, Chloe. Can I cook a little bit? Yes, you can. Can I get this? Yes, you can. So, I'm a little bit of Ina, a little bit of, I don't know, a dash of this, a dash of that, but it's 83 recipes, and the cookbook comes out in September. So I have started to, I was at, as you can see, my thoughts are always very all over the place. I was at church Sunday, and the minister's sermon was about the long way and how so often we think things are supposed to happen in a certain amount of time. And she said, sometimes the long way was the way you were meant to go, for what reason? And ask yourself something right now that's taken the long way. What is the purpose of that? And I said to myself, it took so long for me to get this talk show and get this way, for me to understand that it's not my only thing. You know, people used to go on talk shows and their only thing. I've been very like, if it stays, it stays. Guess what? I wrote a book. I wrote another book. I sold a cookbook. I've just sold 2 TV shows. I just sold another book we haven't even announced yet. And so it made me realize that being a one-trick pony was not going to win the rodeo. And I wouldn't have felt that way at 27 or 37. I'm 53 now, and taking the long road told me, especially as a black woman, being multi-hyphenate is not just an ego trip. It is your value. It's making sure that when you're ready to leave the room, you can leave the room. You don't have to be escorted out and your badge taken from you. Which is what happened to me when they turned my email off. But I was like, damn it, I'm still responding to people. The long route was meant so that I would be mature enough to understand, even the long route with my child. I mean, I was 48 when I got pregnant. I fight differently for my career because I'm fighting for him. Mm-hmm. See, all of that was meant to happen later. Because when I go into contract negotiations, now my husband's a manager and he's really, really shrewd. He's not my manager because he's my husband. I ain't making that mistake. But, but Chloe is like, facts, North Philly, we know. he's gone. He left. That's why I'm talking like this. Poor Tam is like, what the hell did I sign up for?
No, I'm loving it.
No, I negotiate differently. I mean, I was just in a negotiation, and when I joke a lot, and I have, but of course I get nervous, and I go into a meeting, and I'm like, what if they say no? And then I picture my son, and I fight for my son, and thus far since I've had Moses, I have not lost a contract negotiation.
I've not.
Because you fight different. Like, you just do. It's like you see those stories where they say, like, a mom lifted the car off the baby. You know, you're like, oh, my God. Because you fight. Like, when Cardi said, I need cheese for my egg. Do you know how many times I walk into a meeting with that in my head? I'm like, I need cheese for my egg. I got a baby. I need this money. I'm just being honest. It's like, I fight. I mean, I don't go in like Cardi, but Cardi's in my head.
And that's a good person like, to have
no,
in your...
I don't swear like that. most of the time. But when that line, I need cheese for my egg, I got a baby. I was like, that's it. So,
Miss Valiant wants to know, what color did you choose for? Do you choose for yourself that you're most comfortable with?
Orange.
Orange.
Yes. Orange. Orange. Orange.
And finally, what are your favorite books to read?
My favorite books to read are currently, this is a hot list. Let me just tell you, it's a list. You get your pencils, get ready to write this down. Noses Aren't for Picking, bestseller, because we just went through the nose picking stage. Did you know there was a whole book called Noses Aren't? You knew this? Yes, because I would have rather had a nail biter, but I had the nose picker, the four-year-old nose picker. And I'm like, we can't be walking around tearing all baby digging in your nose. What's wrong with you? So it's a very popular book called Noise, and Voices Aren't for Yelling.
Yes.
Because the modulation of a four-year-old, we were backstage, and I was like, use your inside voice. And the Interrupting Chicken. It's a great book. If you have a child who talks a lot like mine and me, it teaches them not to interrupt all the time. It is called Interrupting Chicken. And the chicken just keeps interrupting in the whole book. And we have with us currently a Grouchy Monkey. That's a big one in my house.
Yeah,
because, right, you know, I'm very absorbed. Oh, there's another. I have sold a children's book as well. That's recently. It has not been published yet. We were working on the animations. And it's called The Harlem Honey. My son was born in Harlem. And it's a love letter to Harlem and kids in Harlem and all that. So, yeah, it's all happening.
Where you find the time, I don't know, but we're glad that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you for being
here. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.